Well, good evening, everybody. I'm Tony Giddens. It's my great pleasure to welcome you here this evening to this evening's debate, and I'd like you to welcome our distinguished guest, George Soros. Maybe you give him a round of applause before he even starts. Enough! You can applaud more loudly at the end. Ladies and gentlemen, George Soros is a remarkable man who's had a remarkable life. If you're interested in that life, which I shan't discuss in detail, a lot about it appears in the book, which is the subject of discussion today. There's some very charming and moving anecdotes about George's past life in that book, a kind of flirtation with death in a few pages, and it covers a lot of subjects, this book, so I do recommend it to you. George says rather charmingly in the book that his main task in life is to make the world a better place. I suppose he must be fairly pessimistic about the world, because he doesn't say an even better place. But I think that's a very noble aspiration. George was at the LSE as a penniless student, who I believe cleaned out swimming pools for a living. After that, he's had one of the most successful careers in finance that anyone has had over the past 40 years. But what makes him interesting is the impact which he's had on the world. George has set up foundations in a range of countries, from the ex-Soviet Union, now Russia, of course, Eastern Europe, one of his main preoccupations. He established the Central European University, a major enterprise in itself. He's taken an interest in a range of countries across the world, from Burma through to African countries. And again, if you read his book, he's turning his attention now at last on the United States, the place where, of course, he's lived for many years in the latter part of his life. You read also in the book that George spent quite a lot of the money trying to prevent Mr. Bush being re-elected as President of the United States. This must be a left-leaning institution or something. But I think, you know, you can say he was right to do so, because I think, all prejudice apart, the Bush administration's perhaps been the most inept administration, really, of this century, because, first of all, it redefined political international scene in terms of power. And if you redefine the international scene in terms of power, it's obvious that it won't be only the United States who does so. Other countries do so. And when we look at one of the most serious issues facing us, which is, in my view, as well as George Soros' view, nuclear proliferation, you can see why that is actually intrinsically linked with the definition of the international system as a system of power. Because if you define it that way, then of course other states will also be forced to follow suit. Second, the war on terror has been largely a dysfunctional attempt to contain terror in the world. Third, what's happened to inequality in America? Under the Clinton administration, which was much maligned by the political left at the time, about 15% of the population were moved out of poverty. Well, those people are back in poverty again. The policies of the administration have favored the more affluent groups in the society. And fourthly, the world now confronts climate change shock. Climate change is not something of the future. It exists in the here and now. We confront two things, really: climate change shock, energy shock. And it's only energy shock which has somehow forced the administration to own up to the fact that the United States is a gas-guzzling society as it stands. So there are plenty of reasons, I think, to hope for better American leadership. As I understand the book, George says, and I certainly think, the world needs American leadership. The world does need American leadership, but it needs better leadership that's been provided over the past few years. I should mention in closing this introduction that George is substantial, or as John Major might say, a quite substantial tennis player. And I've had a few chances to play him out on his tennis ranch. I remember one occasion we played with the author, Michael Crichton, who wrote Jurassic Park and so on. and who is about 8 foot tall. But I am happy to tell you he's no good at tennis at all. So at least one of my, you know, I haven't achieved very much. One of my achievements is to be better at tennis than Michael Crichton is, and it was George who made this possible for me. Well, just to outline the format of the debate, we're going to start with Professor David Held. I mean, you have to realize this is the consolidated weight of the Center for Global Governance in front of you, because I'm now part of the Center for Global Governance. David is one of the directors of the Center for Global Governance. Mary is another director of the Center for Global Governance. David is going to start and speak for about 10 minutes on the themes of George's book. He'll be followed by Mary Caldor. Mary is, like David, professor at the LSE. We were very pleased to lure her here from Sussex during the time that I was director of the LSE, and she's done a marvelous job for the institution. And finally, Shami Chakrabarty, who is going to speak third. All of them are going to speak for no more than 11 minutes. And then we'll give a chance to George to reply. Then the floor will be open to discussion. But could I just mention something important? That is that George, and I think it's a good idea, wanted the discussion to be founded on written questions. So if you've got pens and paper with you, maybe you could write questions down as they occur to you, and stewards will come up and down to collect these questions, and we'll sort through them and base at least part of the discussion on this. So again, welcome everybody, and please give a welcome to the global expert on globalization, Professor David Held.
Good evening, George Soros. Welcome to the LSE again. Good evening, audience. This is the occasion for this, at least the excuse for it, is partly a book launch. George Soros has written a new book. You might want to just hold up the copy there. Can you just hold this up? The Age of Fallibility.
This is what tennis players do with
it. I read the book in thinking about... You can sit down now, Tony.
Don't you think someone would like this copy?
That's my copy, actually. Oh.
It takes a lot to get Tony Giddens to sit down.
Right to property. Right to property.
All right, are we ready, ladies and gentlemen?
Yes, we're ready.
All right, thank you very much. Well, I'll speak for about 11 or 12 minutes, because what I really want to do is summarize George's book for you, the audience, so you know what this is a discussion about. And when I read the book, I thought, well, what would I want to say to my students if I were presenting it to them? So I'm going to present George's work. But the first thing I'd like to briefly say is, as Tony said, George says in the beginning of his book that the aim is, quote, to make the world a better place. And to this end, in the book, he develops a number of very interesting theoretical and political and policy ideas, along with some interesting personal reflections, which Mary is going to speak about as well. Now, why should we be interested in George Soros' theoretical and political reflections? Well, George himself gives three reasons. First, because he offers a conceptual framework that helps understand ideas and history. Second, because he holds a clear set of political and ethical beliefs. And third, because I am who I am, or in his words, I have a lot of money. Well, there's clearly something to be said for each of these points. George's stated aim is to help nurture a global open society to complement the level of national politics. This means strengthening the space for democracy and the critical exchange of ideas, strengthening the rule of international law, and developing international institutions which have not kept pace with the growth of global markets and global challenges. In his account, we live in a hopelessly lopsided world, shaped by market-driving institutions with little or no institutional focus on the pressing problems that will shape our future: poverty, climate change, nuclear proliferation, among others. Now, I've recently written on the paradox of our times, which is that the collective issues we must grapple with are increasingly global in scope, and yet the means, the political means for addressing them, are not just local and national, but weak and inadequate. And George is absorbed by a similar set of concerns and is by no means optimistic, unlike Tony perhaps, that we will easily find a way forward, or that we will find a feasible way forward. Now, the main culprit here is, in his book, the political wrongheadedness of the United States. But the problems are rooted in contemporary society And George is developing not just a political but a sociological argument. And I want to summarize his argument briefly in five theses: philosophical, sociological, political, economic, and strategic. That gives you an idea of the overall argument, and then say something briefly about each of these points. Well, first, the philosophical thesis. George Soros suggests that his thinking advances two key principles: reflexivity and fallibility. By reflexivity, he means that human society cannot simply be objectively understood. For society is never simply pre-given. It's shaped, formed, constituted by the active and activities of human subjects. In this process, people are transformed by the very ideas used to describe them. For example, Freud's ideas revolutionized our understanding of sexuality. Marx's ideas changed the nature of the world, for better or worse. As George puts it, and I'll read this quote slowly, "We are part of the world, and what we think becomes part of what we have to think about," end quote. Our understanding is always limited by the ideas in play at the moment and by the intended and unintended consequences of our actions. Because our comprehension is always limited, it is bound to be one-sided, partial, and often downright wrong. We have to live with uncertainty, and yet we cannot escape the burden of constantly testing ideas to see if they can withstand critical scrutiny. Now here comes the sociological thesis, thesis number two, which says that increasingly we live in a society that denies what I've just said, the philosophical arguments. Because contemporary society can be described as a feel-good society. Our desires have been transformed by the rise of consumerism and the application of consumerism to politics. Corporations employ ever more sophisticated methods to sell their goods and motivate consumers, and politics adopts these methods, focus groups, and the framing of messages to cater to the desires of the electorate. US politics in particular has become caught in a political spiral in which political leaders compete for votes by promising ever more and never threatening the rising sense that we all have of personal entitlement. Identity gets locked into an orgy of instant gratification, or the pursuit of instant gratification. Choices are simple. Which holiday? Which clothes? Actually, if you've been shopping with your partner, George, you'll know that which clothes is a very difficult question. But which holiday, which clothes, which leaders for that matter? The feel-good societies want feel-good politics, and they have little concern for the pursuit of truth. In this world, the one thing that humans rarely reflect on is their own vulnerability and finitude. Death or the fear of death is put aside in the pursuit of pleasure. The feel-good society represses what George calls the ultimate spoiler of feeling good, death itself. And yet the fragility of a world based on consumption can't repress our fears forever. And it was into this superficial, feel-good world that Osama bin Laden sprang, because he understood that Western civilization is frightened of death, and 9/11 dramatized this message, or spread this message. Now enter the third argument, the political thesis. 9/11 and the vulnerabilities of contemporary society were exploited by President Bush and the neocon political project. The Bush administration magnified the fear of death and used it to further its own ambitions. People fell into line under the banner of the war on terror. But the war on terror is a misrepresentation of reality and a mistaken metaphor. In pursuing American supremacy, the war on terror, to quote George Soros again, killed more innocent civilians in Iraq than the terrorists on 9/11, humiliated and tortured many Iraqis, and created innocent victims, end quote. In the US, the president pursued simultaneously the extension of executive powers and elevated the executive branch over other offices. Thus, the Bush administration itself became an enemy of the open society, although a reflection, perhaps, of the feel-good society. Instead of extending the rule of law, seeking dialogue with the Muslim world, and developing the means to deal not with the warmongers of 9/11, but the criminals of 9/11, the US returned once again to what it understood, old war techniques, and made us all less secure. And this is a time when global challenges like nuclear proliferation and the enveloping energy crisis make international cooperation more urgent, not less. Okay so far, George? The fourth is an economic thesis. The rise of globalization has been shaped by a market fundamentalist project which has weakened confidence in politics and political solutions to collective problems. Freedom is granted to capital, but not to other factors of production, notably labor. The externalities of markets too often go unchecked, and political capacity fails to meet and keep up with the problems of collective problems. Combine this with the single message that the Bush administration and its foreign policy sends to all, as Tony Giddens has already said, it's legitimate to pursue national and sectional interests above all else, and the question arises, how will we find the political resources to deal with life's collective problems? This is most clearly dramatized in the contemporary global energy crisis, whose many facets include the war on terror, the invasion of Iraq, the radicalization of Islam, China and Russia's self-interested energy policies, and the ultimate weakening of American power and influence. The fifth and final thesis of the book is a strategic and tactical one. The US needs to regain its position as a legitimate leader of the free world by acknowledging its failures and once again contributing to the strengthening of the liberal international order, of which it was one of the great, if not the greatest, architects. It will have to pursue a truly humble foreign policy, engaging with the views of others and paying attention to their interests. Yet such a US leadership role seems a long way from being fulfilled. The EU is unlikely to step into the breach because the EU is currently weak as well. Alternative leadership, however, exists in civil society, and civil society needs to exert what influence it can on governments in the name of law, democracy, and justice. But the US is too powerful to simply sidestep or ignore. It's an enormous negative factor, and hence, in the end, George Soros argues that we need to plead for a fundamental rethinking of America's role. Now that, Tony Giddens, was my summary of George's arguments, so I need just a few moments to make my own, and I'll just try and use no more than 3 or 4 minutes, if that's all right.
I thought we should set out 2 minutes, otherwise the audience won't have a chance to participate.
Okay, well, I want to be very brief then. I think there are many things that can be said about these arguments. I think they place George Soros at the forefront of political criticism, and the analytical machinery he develops is enormously productive. But there are interesting questions to raise, and I will now, given the time pressure, only raise them very briefly. To begin with, I think George overstates the nature of the fallibility of reason. Because if we develop an argument of radical fallibility, which is your primary claim, then you can tend to undermine the truth claims that you yourself want to make. And it seems to me you begin to undermine the status, for example, of the social and political sciences, which are an enormous ally in dealing with the dogmas of politicians. The second thing I want to say is that underpinning a commitment to openness are very many important principles, like the sanctity of life, the equal moral status of each and every human being, the idea that principles of human beings as active subjects, not passive subjects, the notion of personal responsibility and accountability, and many others. And these, in some sense, seem to me the absolute foundations of openness, and they require a more explicit defense than one can find in your work. Thirdly, I worry about George's sociological thesis, because I think it tends to overstate the degree to which people are passive consumers of culture. It seems clear that if Clinton had been allowed to stand for a third time, he might have won. Al Gore did. In addition, the survey evidence shows that even before the second election of George W. Bush, a significant proportion of Americans were surprisingly internationalist, pro the UN, and worried about unilateral US action in the world. More multilateralism, not less, was taken to be the key lessons of 9/11 by an overwhelming majority of US voters, according to the Chicago Council of Foreign Relations survey 2004. So it's not just that the US is a divided country by region and coast and so on, but that people combine complex and contradictory belief systems which can be mobilized in different directions. Of course, George's arguments show how these can be exploited to serve a particular agenda. But if we overstate this, we lose sight of the possibilities of building on the reflexive, often wise opinions of citizens to build more progressive coalitions. Finally, Tony Giddens, before you get impatient with me, I think the political alternatives to the Bush administration...
I think we've got to finish, actually.
Well, I'll just finish on this one final point. I think the alternatives to the Bush worldview need perhaps to be set out more boldly even than you do, George. Because he stands, of course, for a hegemonic project which is about the globalizing of American rules and justice. But I think, as Mary is going to argue, and as I have argued, and as the UN High Panel recently suggested, we need to be clear about the alternative, which is a human security doctrine based on multilateralism and common rules, which seeks order through law and justice, which seeks to relink security and human rights, which aims to make the world safe, not just for American rules and justice, but for global rules and impartial, global justice and impartial rules. So I'm not sure here the challenge is, and this is my final word, just to say we need a better G1. I think we need less of the G1, less of the G7, less of the G8. The rule of law and the strengthening of global governance requires the strong obey the rules of law as much as the weak, and that we need to lock in the United States into a stronger multilateral order. I would have finished with one other point, but I'll grant Tony, I should sit down.
Mary, you're going to sit down. You're going to stay there.
Oh, no, I'll go and stand up, too, just to give it to the top. Well, I must say, I really enjoyed the book. I've actually read it twice, because I read it in manuscript first. And it's an easy read, but what I really like about the book is that it has, in a way, created its own genre. It's not an autobiography, it's not a political memoir, it's an explanation of why George Soros has adopted particular strategies, both in financial markets and through his foundations. And at the same time, it's a commentary on our times by someone who has extraordinary individual insights. I feel enormously privileged that George Soros has chosen to launch the book here at the LSE and under the auspices of our centre. I think few individuals, if any, can claim to have changed things in the ways that he has. Unlike many rich people who believe you can solve problems through throwing money at them, I think what's been unique about George Soros is that he's always analysed situations and worked out where he could make a difference. And I think what this book is about is explaining the process that he's gone through. And I'd just like to mention a few of these because over my life, for some reason, I've often followed the same issues, so I've been very aware of them. And my first encounter with his work was in Eastern Europe in the 1980s when George Soros set up the Polish and Hungarian foundations. And what that did was quite extraordinary because he negotiated these foundations with governments. They were officially established, but at the same time, they provided autonomous, independent space for culture and for intellectual development. And that idea of expanding autonomous space, if you like, islands of open society, was the key strategy of dissident intellectuals. And I think that through this, I could give you a long lecture on how it actually happened, but I'm not going to. He really contributed to the end of the Cold War in a very important way. So that's just one example. Another example is that I believe with many Soviet scientists that George Soros saved Soviet science. At a moment when none of the scientists were getting any income, when it looked terrible, he simply created a fund which paid Soviet scientists, and he describes how he did that. But I've heard many people in Russia saying, George Soros saved Soviet science. And we could give lots and lots of other examples, paying the salaries of people in Georgia and policemen, which helped to legitimize the Rose Revolution government, helping governments to establish foreign experts that could negotiate with the IMF, the Central European University, which I imagine quite a few people here are graduates of, all kinds of initiatives that I think have really made a difference. And the book is peppered with fascinating examples that you can look at. Now, the other point that I think is very crucial about the book is the point that David explained about the reflexive character of his work, and George himself is reflexive. So he looked at what happened in the last American elections, and the fact that despite the fact that he tried to defeat George Bush, he failed. And he asked himself, why did I fail? And so in a way, this book is a critical reflection on what's gone wrong with America. And I'm very much in agreement with this central thesis that the war on terror is a false metaphor, that somehow the perceptions that the Bush administration have conveyed
through their own statements, through the media, are out of kilter with global realities, however you define those realities. What I'm not sure about, and I mention it's not actually important to the conclusion, is whether everything changed on 9/11. That's what I'm not sure about, because I think America went wrong much earlier. I think what happened after the end of the Cold War was that America never had its own perestroika. I think if you try to understand American foreign policy, it was profoundly shaped by World War II and the stunning victory that was won by the United States in the name of democracy. And I think that shaped post-war policy to a large degree. The role of the federal government, the rise of the military-industrial complex, the way that America behaved in the Cold War, in my view, was very much a kind of reenactment of the Second World War. This idea that America's role is to be a crusader for democracy, using superior technology, particularly military technology, was deeply embedded in that Cold War period. I talk in my own writing about the imaginary war, the idea that we lived in the Cold War period as though World War II had never ended, with all the exercises, all the spying, all the hostile rhetoric. I don't want to say by this that communism was not a threat, but I think communism was a threat to the people of the Soviet Union and the people of Eastern Europe rather than a threat to us. And that the idea of an imaginary war actually helped to sustain communism rather than the opposite. And I think what happened at the end of the Cold War was that none of this was questioned. The people who are in the Bush administration were the children of the Cold War. People like Cheney, Rumsfeld, Pearl were all in the Reagan administration. And they had learnt to live within this idea of a permanent war atmosphere. And 9/11 gave them a chance to recreate it. And of course, all those institutions, the Beltway Bandits, the defense industry, all were able to participate in that opportunity. I call this, and David mentioned it, old war thinking. I mean that the wars of the 20th century were old wars. Terror is very much a part of new wars, the kind of wars that we see in the Middle East, in Africa, in the Balkans. And traditional military power is very ineffective in new war situations. That's what we're seeing now in Iraq, Afghanistan, Chechnya, or Gaza. Traditional military power, old war thinking, can't bring peace. On the contrary, it can't. It actually makes new wars worse. It produces terrorists. So the war on terror is actually manufacturing terrorists. But what if that's what the Bush administration wants? If what they want, and Rumsfeld has told us many times, this is going to be a long war. What if they want a permanent war atmosphere? Maybe they really do understand the reality. I mean, maybe I'm being a bit conspiratorial. But this is what they want. They see their power resting on this narrative of Americans' role, both at home and abroad. They think they can reproduce their power through the atmosphere of fear. And the question is, are they right? I think the last elections proved they were, but are they in the long term right? And that's, I think, where global open society comes in. What I would call global civil society, but terminology is fine. I think what we have to do, and that's what we learned from Eastern Europe, from the Hungarian and Polish foundations, is to create spaces free of fear where we can make use of critical reason and really debate realities or debate how to end terror. Now, the final thing I want to say is something. The book is full of very good concrete proposals. And I just would like to say something about them because I think it's really important for us to discuss them. First of all, nuclear proliferation. George is very concerned about nuclear proliferation, and so am I. One of the things that really upset me last week was Gordon Brown's announcement that there would be a successor to Trident. Why did he announce it? I think for political reasons. He cared about the editorial in the next day's Sun, or the Daily Telegraph. And I just think this is too important to be used for political reasons. I think it's a very dangerous moment when we're trying to stop proliferation. I think our nuclear weapons actually are not independent at all, and they tie us in to the war on terror. They tie us into American foreign policy. And above all, if we're trying to build a world based on international law, based on human rights, nuclear weapons are completely opposite to that. How can you talk about not killing civilians when you have nuclear weapons in your armory? So George's proposal is a very nice, simple one. It is that there should be a new non-proliferation regime, and that all nuclear weapons, that's including the existing nuclear weapons powers, should open up their nuclear weapons for inspection and for international supervision. And I think that's a great idea, and I think that's something that those of us in Britain could raise when we're debating the successor to Trident, which we will be debating over the next few months. Secondly, I really like his proposals for the European Union, and I'm going to mention two. One is he thinks it's really important that the EU has a global role based on the spread of peace and freedom, exporting the internal achievements of the European Union. This is very similar to my own thinking and to some of the work we're doing at the centre. We're pushing hard for Europe to have a human security doctrine, and we're working with the Finnish and German presidencies over this. I believe there's a lot of popular support for this kind of thinking, and that to emphasize this policy would be one way to get Europe out of its current paralysis. Another idea which I really like very much in the book is the need for a European energy policy, like the old coal and steel policy, which would enable the Europeans together instead of individually to negotiate with Russia over oil, and would mean that pipelines were European as opposed to national. Finally, there's a really nice last idea in the book, which is to treat the global energy crisis as a combination of the energy shortage, the resource curse, and global warming. I think that's a great idea, and in a way, it's a policy idea as much as an analysis, because what it suggests is that renewable, localized sources of energy, as well as energy saving, is the answer to all of these three problems. Well, I think George Soros not only puts forward these ideas, but he tries to make them a reality. And I think these kinds of practical proposals really contribute to global open society as focal points for debate. But also, I want to add as a final point that George Soros has also created an infrastructure for global open society through his foundations. George always used to criticize my activities by saying that networking is not working. But actually, he's created a network that really works and I think is helping to address today's global challenges.
Just before Shami starts, can I just ask how many people have written down questions? I think you could pass them along to the edge of the rows and I'll start looking at them before we get sort of near the end and encourage other people to write them, although if we can't answer them all, I'll put them all in a bag for George to answer on the plane. If you put your email down, he can send you answers. Penny. You can talk from there.
I will. I'll stay seated if I may, because lecterns highlight my lack of height and fallibility in a very unflattering way. It's a great treat to be here. It's always nice when the ranty campaigner is allowed in to sit at the table with all these great
minds. I'm a ranty campaigner.
All right, there you go. And I want to just talk a little more about the war on terror, the false metaphor of the war on terror from very much a British perspective. And to do so knowing that this week will be the anniversary of the atrocity in this great city last summer. and to give a little further take on the false metaphor, because we certainly agree about that, and to talk about the threat to the open society that the war on terror is posing in this country, in this great mature democracy at this moment in time. I'd like to begin by quoting the lead suicide bomber, Mohammed Sadiq Khan, who you may remember recorded a rather chilling piece of videotape, we think sometime in the last 6 months of his life before his suicide and murder. He said two things that have stayed with me very much. On the one hand, he said, "We are at war, and I am a soldier." And on the other hand, he said, "You have gassed and murdered and tortured my Muslim brothers and sisters." So this is the justification for what he is about to do. So there you have it. He pushes hawks and doves buttons alike, and the war on terror metaphor turns a murderer or a criminal into a soldier, which is a disastrous thing for a metaphor to do, and in fact is counter to successive British government's approaches to dealing with terrorism in the Northern Irish context, where, as many people in this room will remember, it was a great aspiration of paramilitaries to be considered soldiers, and it was a great aspiration of successive British governments not to treat them as soldiers. So that is a tragic consequence, counterproductive consequence of this metaphor. I would, thinking then of the dove's buttons, that, you know, because I am a unashamed bleeding heart, you have gassed and murdered and tortured my Muslim brothers and sisters. We, of course, know that if we're hypocritical about the values of open society, we're not desperately good at exporting them around the globe. And I think that the other obvious disaster of this false metaphor of the war on terror, and you deal with this at length in your book, George, is that it's not that I don't think that 9/11 wasn't very real and didn't take a lot of lives in the way that conventional wars can. It's not that I don't fear there will be more episodes of that kind, including in this city. It's that there is a massive conceptual problem with the war on terror from a democratic point of view, from a rule of law point of view. Now, we all accept and have done in this country that in times of war, we are prepared, if necessary, to suspend some of the normal mechanisms of democracy and the rule of law. And we do so in a conventional war in the hope that at the end of the war, those rights and freedoms and the normal functioning of democracy will be handed back to us. But at least in a conventional war, as in the Second World War in this country, we, the people, will know when the war is over. We will know there will be a little white flag waved somewhere, there will be a peace treaty signed, or there will be an obvious conquest. We will know when that war is over. It may be a very long war, but objective reality... I mean, I'm not going to get into all the philosophical stuff about truth and objectivity, but we, the people, will have some idea that we can test to satisfy our senses that the war is over. Now, my problem with the long war, the new normal, or all the rest of this awful language, is that it is, by definition, an unending war, and we have to rely on President Bush Jr. the 23rd to tell our grandchildren, "It's okay, guys, just one more big push and we can shut down Guantanamo and the war will be over." And there's a massive problem from the point of view of fallibility of open society and of democracy and the rule of law. So I have a problem with this false metaphor for hawkish and dove-like reasons. It's counterproductive in the struggle, and I do think there is a struggle, not a clash of civilizations or anything like that, because many Muslims around the world completely sign up to my idea of human rights. But it's completely counterproductive in a philosophical pursuit of open society or democracy that, as you rightly say in your book, has to come with the rule of law, and I would say as a component in the rule of law, some non-negotiable rights and freedoms. And I guess I sort of agree with David that we should be not just discussing fallibility and imperfection and open society, but having the hard edge in there too. Because the consequence of the fallibility and the need for open society is this rule of law model that does have some hard-edged inspirational values like no torture and free speech and fair trials, which in my view are just as inspirational for young disillusioned people around the globe as anything that Al-Qaeda can offer. So just then to broaden just for a minute, because I want the audience to have their say, into the threats that we are facing in this country to the open society at the moment. The rule of law is being rubbished by politicians of all persuasions. The idea of independent judges is being rubbished in parts of the popular media and by government, by cabinet ministers. In Britain, this great mature democracy that to some extent gave certain human rights principles to this big discussion after the Second World War. We have popular tabloid newspaper campaigns to scrap the Human Rights Act, which is the closest thing we have to a Bill of Rights, if not quite that. We're in trouble. The open society is facing that level of threat. I have to pay tribute to my friend Henry Porter, or to name and shame him. He's already been named and shamed, so let's pay tribute to him as a great defender of the open society. He's here today, who has been writing articles that have highlighted for ordinary Britons the threat to their rights and freedoms. And he possibly even tempted the leader of the Conservative Party to enter the discussion. But it's incredibly important, I think, if we are offering a truly global philosophy of open society, democracy and the rule of law, that we don't just stand up for the rights of freeborn Englishmen. Not just civil liberties, but human rights, universal. They apply to foreign nationals as well as British nationals. And I think that has to be part of the antidote, a hard-edged, confident, robust exposition of what we believe, not just what we're against. Mary very delicately and rightly said it's not just about throwing money at problems. I have to say, when Liberty, with Henry Porter and a few other people, is taking on Mr. Murdoch and Ms. Wade, it's not just about throwing money at the problem, but George, a little would help.
Well, I'll be very brief in order to leave room, time for discussion. On the war on terror, I think you made a very good point, which I didn't make, about terrorists actually being upgraded into soldiers by this metaphor. But the main point is that war is not the right way to respond, but it has become accepted because there is no other way to describe what needs to be done. So we now in America recognize that the invasion of Iraq was a terrible blunder, but we still are framing the discussion in terms of the war on terror. And that is what President Bush is using over and over again. And the Democrats have bought into it. And I don't believe that America can actually correct its mistakes until it recognizes that the war on terror is a false metaphor that has led to false policies. Because war, by its very nature, creates innocent victims. War against terrorists who don't let their whereabouts be known is even more likely to result in the wrong people being hit. And then war against terror, which is an abstraction, can be used to cover a multitude of sins. And in fact, it has been used in exactly that way. It has been used to claim extensive powers for the presidency, undermining the very foundations of the division of powers, which is at the core of American open society. And for quite a while, it could be used to condemn any criticism of the Bush administration's policies as unpatriotic. And it's during that period that we were led into the war on Iraq on false pretenses. So we have this. This needs yet to sink in, and it has. And the book aimed at the American audience it seeks to make that point.
George, but have you got an alternative metaphor?
No, that is a remarkable thing. That the only other expression is counter-terrorism, which is, in a way, more honest description of what the war on terror is. So we have to recognize that we are the victims of a false metaphor exactly because there is no other metaphor for describing it.
Shouldn't you be inventing one, though?
Well, you know, I leave that to the manufacturers of messages.
It's not a message issue, though. It's an issue that something people can grasp, but actually is an alternative position which can be specified in the way in which they try to specify their position.
Sure. Yes, it's a manifestation of how our misconceptions can have a very detrimental results. I don't see any other way to explain it. And that's why I think you need the conceptual framework, which says that misconceptions have unintended consequences. And then you look at the consequences of the war on terror, and people can see how it has been counterproductive, how it has actually increased the terrorist threat. So there is no simple solution because the world is a very complicated place. Reality is always more complicated than our understanding of reality. And we need to recognize that, and we need to recognize how a phrase like the war on terror can actually undermine the position of the most powerful nation on earth that was not in, could not be endangered by any other state or combination of states. And this false metaphor has undermined America's power and influence in the world in a way that was really, quite amazing. So this is actually what I'm trying to, I felt I needed a book to say this. If I could say it in a word, I wouldn't have written the book.
David, did you want to make a comment on?
Well, I largely agree with George on this matter, right? But I think there is another language which is partly in the book and it's partly in your comments, which is that 9/11 was a crime against the United States and a crime against humanity. We have a language for talking about crimes against countries and crimes against humanity. And that language is already embedded in the development of international law. So the response to 9/11 should have been about bringing criminals to justice within the framework of law and extending the consensus to support that law, instead of glamorizing those who committed crimes by calling them soldiers and using the metaphor of terror. And I think that is in your book, actually, and that provides a better, more robust, alternative language.
Good. I think it's a very good point, actually.
Do you want to make some further points?
Well, let me just make one other point, because, and that's about the role of Europe and the European Union, because the book is addressed also to European audience, and I think that it's easy to be critical of America, and particularly of the Bush administration, but I think people in Europe tend to do it as sort of passive spectators, saying, well, the world is the way it is, and there's nothing much we can do about it. And that, I think, is false. I think that the European Union could do a great deal more if it had a little more cohesion. And there is a crisis in the European Union which is independent of the mistakes and false policies of the U.S. Administration, and that is a crisis of Europe as an open society. I think, to me, Europe is the prototype of an open society, which could serve as a model for a global open society, because there is a delegation of sovereignty for the pursuit of common goals, a specific delegation of sovereignty. And the baby that was thrown out with the bathwater of the constitutional defeat is a common European foreign policy, and add to that a common European energy policy. And I think you have a mission for Europe that ought to inspire people, and people ought to really clamor for it, and force the governments to their governments to engage in a common foreign policy.
That will be the day. Did you want to say something?
Yes, if I may. One of the things that I think you touch on, George, in various places is the attraction of dogma. And there are all sorts of reasons why people are attracted to it. I mean, I'm quite interested in your fear of death idea, because I think one of the problems that we have in Britain that predates 9/11, actually, is that a difficulty in coping with risk. And the way in which whenever something terrible happens, a little girl is murdered, a bomb goes off, all sorts of terrible things, the cry goes up, Prime Minister, what will you do to make sure that this never, ever happens again? To get us a little bit closer to that wonderful utopia, the risk-free society, as if we will annihilate death. And too often, because we don't have proper leadership, too often the answer is, fear not, I shall return to the House of Commons next week with a new piece of legislation. which will almost abolish death. But I think that the end of Death Act. But I think that one of the problems with the open society is that its enemies have all the best tunes. We've just struggled with a slogan that would, you know, why does George Bish and co have to have all the best slogans? And I'm prepared to adopt the language of the open society rather than the language of liberal democracy, because, as you rightly point out, liberals become a dirty word. Liberal with a small L is now a dirty word. But there is a little too much of the feel of moral relativism about the language of liberal values. And in my view, not enough of the confident human rights, rule of law component that says we actually have an alternative philosophy that is a component in the open society. Now, it might be there because of fallibility, it might be there because we're preserving democracy, but in order to preserve it, you have to have these hard-edged, quite inspirational values, which religious people actually find, you know, apart from the mad ones, you know, religious people actually are comfortable with human rights because they're comfortable with the concept of this precious nature of every individual human life. Sometimes atheists or people, you know, progressives in politics have difficulty with that, and I think you can get to the same place not by believing in God, but by believing that some hard-edged, non-negotiable, universal human rights values are essential to the preservation of the open society.
Yeah, thank you.
Would you like to say some more?
No. Okay.
Well, we got a whole bunch of questions here, so I do apologise to those we won't get to, but I will genuinely stuff them in George's pocket, if he does what he will with them. He might feel like answering some of them, maybe.
Well, we are going to establish, I think, a website, so we'll probably post them there, maybe.
Okay. Well, the first question I picked out is there a politician in the US you believe is capable of leading America in the manner you've set out? If yes, who are they, and are they electable?
It's the same question as I ask in the book. Because in fact, there isn't.
I think he's saying buy the book. He needs the royalties, you know.
No, because I don't have the answer.
He's saying vote George Soros.
I don't want to sell the book on false pretenses.
Well, give us the answer now.
What?
Give us the answer.
This is why I believe we have to get rid of this war on terror metaphor to be able to come up with an inspiring alternative. I hope that if we still have two years to the next election, that somebody will come forward and articulate a a worthwhile alternative. But at the moment, you don't really have it.
Well, could that be Al Gore?
Well, Al Gore has emerged as...
Re-emerged, he has.
No, because he was a failure. He was a failure as a Democratic candidate because he listened to the professionals and he tried to follow their advice, and he shifted, and since the advice shifted, he shifted his position. And people could see that there was something phony about his positions, and that hurt him in the elections. Since then, he's been liberated. He's basically an excellent university professor. He's very didactic, and that's not
an insult.
No, that's not what people want from.
All excellent university professors.
No, look, he has done a tremendous work on global warming. He converted me. I'm a recent convert. I found his presentation really convincing. And he's been indefatigable in going around. And also in the 2004 elections, he really was the statesman who gave the most profound and persuasive speeches. Like, he had a speech on the fear, on the politics of fear and so on. However, he cannot run because he would lose the status that he has achieved. And he says, you know, I've been through it, it's demeaning, I don't want to do it again. He could be drafted, and maybe he will be drafted, and that would be then a fabulous accomplishment for America, putting up with a professor willing to, you know, willing to listen to his lectures. So that's the situation with Gore. He's not a candidate. I think that actually, I'm afraid that Hillary, for whom I have very high regard, is too much boxed into this war on terror position to be able to extricate herself. So that is, I think, weighs her down. So I think you need a new figure. And maybe somebody will emerge.
Are there any Americans in the room?
When?
You have to have been born in the United States to be eligible for this draft.
You have to.
Well, thank you. I would point out that quite a few countries in the world are run by professors who have become heads of state. I can think of 5 or 6 offhand, and they haven't done too badly in the job, actually.
Well, there's Jed Bartlett in the West Wing, who's very good.
There are several questions about India and China. On the same kind of line, really, what role do you envisage India and China playing in relation to the containment of US unilateralism, plus the rise of India and China in relation to US power more generally? Several of the questions mentioned.
Well, talking about China first, China has emerged as China is the major beneficiary of globalization. And it's very dynamic and in many ways opening up. But in the last few years, couple of years, partly in response to the Bush administration's nationalist agenda, because basically it's a nationalist agenda that we have been pursuing, China is also increasingly nationalist. Now, they have a doctrine of harmonious development, which says that we want to basically get rich and accumulate wealth and avoid conflict. And I think it's a very wise policy. But their perceived need to find energy sources is driving them associate with and rogue regimes. Mm-hmm. And to some extent, again, the United States is responsible because we did not allow them to acquire UNOCAL when they bid for it. We should have actually allowed them to buy UNOCAL, provided they would cooperate with the international community, for instance, in dealing with Burma, where UNOCAL has important oil and gas interests. So China is now providing credit to Angola, deeply involved in Sudan, fated President Karimov of Uzbekistan a week after he conducted a massacre in Andijan, conferred an honorary degree on Mugabe of Zimbabwe. So this is the one area where China is coming into conflict and is a spoiler. I'm very much engaged in trying to reduce the ill effects of the resource curse, the fact that when you have natural resources, you usually have poverty, but worse government than in poorer countries that don't have natural resources. And a lot of progress has been made, but very much under the leadership of the Blair government, which sponsors the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative. And we are making a lot of progress in that area, and China and to a lesser extent India are becoming the spoilers in their search for energy. So that's at least partially the answer. But I mean, the one of the reasons that we now have a global energy crisis is a very positive development of China and India and other less developed countries in the last few years, as a result of which they've become big consumers of energy and have actually increased the demand at a time when the supply is now very constrained. So you really have a serious global energy crisis, which has a number of components, and this is one of them.
Well, just building on that, one question says, speaking of energy policy and common European energy policy, what are your views on the possible outcome of energy negotiations at the G8 summit at St. Petersburg? And you might perhaps say something about your views of what's happening in Russia, given that Mr. Putin has his own war on terror and is doing a few things which I know not many people sitting on this platform especially approve of.
Yes. Basically, Russia is using its very strong position as an energy supplier to re-establish, I mean, it's actually really quite a nefarious kind of development, because you have private companies or companies acting as intermediaries between the state, the various entities of the state. So, for instance, Putin expropriated the assets of Yukos, putting Khodorkovsky in jail, and the assets were then auctioned, bought by a fly-by-night company, and resold to Rosneft at a price differential which is unknown. And so the people who control the state, the Siloviki, actually are personally enriching themselves with billions of dollars worth in this process. Now Rosneft is being launched on the London Stock Exchange, and I think it's an issue that ought not to be allowed to proceed. But it will, I think, and it will in a way sort of complete the picture of that particular robbery. And also in dealing with Ukraine, the Turkmen gas is bought by a company which at one price is then resold at another price, and private individuals are getting rich, and those private individuals may well be connected with the Ukrainian government. They were in the past under Kuchma, and in the case of Uzbekistan, the president's daughter, I think, is a shareholder in the company that is exporting, buying the Uzbek gas and reselling it to Gazprom at another price. So this is a very distressing situation, and I think that Russia is acting as a monopolist, vis-a-vis as a monopoly supplier, and it's essential for Europe to have a coordinated energy policy to be able to stand up as an equal partner in negotiating with Russia. And if they are unable to do it, then I think the dependence on Russian energy is excessive. And I think if this this point were properly articulated, you could get Russia to agree to the European Energy Charter, which would require the pipelines to be used as highways with multiple suppliers using it, instead of being in the hands of a monopoly supplier.
What about Russia and G8, though? I mean,
I think they're desperate
to have G8 in St. Petersburg. They've built all these new roads and so on. It's a major thing for them.
I think it's very important for Putin, for his respectability. And of course, we didn't talk about the loss of freedoms internally. The state reasserting control over every instrument, the executive, the Duma, the opposition, the media, and civil society. So you are recreating a very strong centralized authoritarian state, which would be in a way endorsed by this G8 meeting, but fortunately enough issues have been raised that probably it will not be a sort of a simple blessing of Putin. But there's a danger that after the G8, he will feel freer to move further in consolidating central power.
All you people fanning yourselves, do not despair, because I think this will have to be the last question. There are a lot of questions here about finance, which people naturally ask you. So I ought to pick just one, which says, on the US dollar, can you comment?
No.
On a possible further weakening of the currency.
No, I don't think I should comment on that.
Well, then we'll
I'll make a general comment on the financial markets generally, because
in the Chinese currency.
All that. I mean, basically, you have a basic imbalance with the U.S. in particular, consuming, let's say, 6-7% more than producing, having a current account deficit, and China and other Asian countries running a surplus. Now, this actually could go on indefinitely because the producing countries are willing to finance that overconsumption. So it's a willing borrower and a willing lender, and that could actually go on. But there is a problem with the American consumer, which has benefited from the rapid rise in the value of housing. And the equity could be withdrawn from the increased value, and basically half that amount is spent. And that amount is very large. It's $900 billion in last year, with half of which is spent, if it's true that half is spent, it's a stimulus of $450 billion to the economy. And that has been the motor, the driving force of the global economy. Now housing, the boom is abating. Housing prices are still rising, but only a few percent. They may actually fall for a while because there has been over production. And that is the, whether this can be absorbed, whether the adjustment of the reduced spending by households of their capital appreciation in housing, whether that can be absorbed, is the big unanswered question confronting the global economy.
Well, let me thank the panel and thank George Soros especially for coming. Do you want to say some last words? Do you?
Well, I would quite like just to say two things, actually, if I may. One is I just want to emphasize what George was saying about the European Union, and I think one of the big problems in the world, and maybe in a way that's a slight criticism, is that we do all think the US has to be the leader. And why does the US have to set the agenda? And actually, if the EU was a little bit more coherent and did get its act together, it could really start to set the agenda. So I think that aspect of what George is saying is really important. It's no good just sitting back and saying we're either for or against the war on terror. We do have
quick
to
points,
offer
though,
an alternative. And the second point I just wanted to make was about this question, what's the alternative to the war on terror? I very much agree with both Shami and David that we have to be for the hard things, like human rights and international law. But in the end, international law and human rights do depend on public support. They depend on a global open society. And if we're really thinking of how to end the war on terror, then I think there really has to be a kind of public campaign. And that's why the idea, this is a little message, the idea of citizens against terror, which is citizens against both the war on terror and terror, I think is a really nice, snappy, good idea.
Shannon, do you want to say something?
Thank you for having me, and thank you for agreeing with me that the war on terror is a bad idea. if we're doing these little plugs, the book is very interesting, but please, all of you that are here, join Liberty as well. www.liberty-human-rights.org.uk.
Can I just conclude by reading out a comment that Anita Birkenich provided, which isn't a question but a nice letter. I would like to use this opportunity to thank you, George Soros, for giving me and all the other Soros supplementary grant recipients the opportunity to continue our education by giving us the necessary support. You've made a huge difference in our lives, and he's made a huge difference in many people's lives, so please give him a round of applause.